You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Coronavirus, COVID-19, call it what you will. My guest today is a researcher at the European University Institute in Florence. Niall Colan specialises in EU biolaw. Niall, I don't want to sound facetious, but how are you?
I'm actually very well because I had the luck of managing to get out in time. So I'm in London, which I have to say a lot of my fellow students have followed suit with. And there's a few who are kind of still holed up in the Institute or nearby, but quite a few of us have managed to get home.
Well, I'm very glad you're with us and you're safe. You've written a very well-researched and timely piece for our blog called Rights in a Time of Quarantine. So for anyone interested in the European law perspective on this current crisis, I would urge you to read Niall's post of the 17th of March. Of course, things are changing fast, but let's start with what you describe now to be the huge dilemma facing Europe, particularly the country you're in, or you were in, Italy, with, as you say, mass interferences with whole populations, liberties on one side, and the very weighty public interest in protecting lives on the other. What, if anything, do human rights have to say about all this?
Well, it's an interesting time because it can feel like a time of complete state of exception whereby necessity makes the law and anything goes. But that's not really the case. Human rights law continues to apply. And whilst it is very flexible because of the factors you just mentioned, and it gives authorities a very wide margin of appreciation, and particularly with such great uncertainty where there's an exceptionally weighty public interest in the measures they're pursuing, and indeed possibly positive obligations to protect the population, it's not unlimited, and it's not unlimited for a good reason. And the essential reason for that is that human rights law must continue to set some very minimum standards. So, for instance, ensuring there's some procedure to identify the most vulnerable before confining them to home, preventing overt discrimination, ensuring state agents enforcing a ban are held to account, and also to place limits on how long this lasts, ensuring that the measures are always tightly linked to the aim, because there have already been reports of this crisis being used as an excuse, essentially, by more repressive governments to crack down on other freedoms in a way that's not linked directly to the crisis. So this is why human rights law can act as a kind of basic code to try and ensure that whilst the authorities have discretion, it's not abused.
Just can we get into the detail that you outline in your article? I mean, again, this may change, but you say some very interesting things about the Italian movement restrictions and the impact upon them, or the relevance to them, of Article 5 of the European Convention of Human Rights and the lesser-known Article 2, Protocol 4 to the European Convention of Human Rights. So can we just have a look at Italy to begin with?
The first question that comes up in terms of human rights law is the movement limitations, and the most appropriate article, at least in Italy, under which to analyse this is Article 2 of Protocol 4. Article 2, one of this prohibits restrictions on internal movement within a state. There are other parts of the article that prohibit movement between states. An interesting side of this is that the UK hasn't actually signed Protocol 4, so similar limitations in the UK not fall within this article. Instead, they'd have to be analysed under other parts of the convention, such as Article 8.
So for our purposes here in the UK, the next most relevant article or provision of the convention is Article 5, which prohibits deprivation of liberty. Could you explain how that might apply in these current circumstances?
Yes, well, Article 5 is one of the most important articles of the Convention, and what it essentially does is set out a very limited set of grounds on which people can be deprived of their liberty. So the traditional case is imprisonment, but it can extend much beyond that. And in this case, what's relevant is it also extends to house arrest, at least in certain cases. And in particular, it seems fairly clear that permanent house arrest, i.e. 24 hours a day, with no exceptions, amounts to deprivation of liberty within Article 5. And when that applies, the safeguards set out in that article are triggered. So the question then is, what the state has done and the procedure that's followed is compliant with that article.
I know we don't have any current case law immediately applicable to this, but in your article you do mention a number of cases in the past relating to other justifications for breaching Article 5, in particular the case of Enhorn and Sweden of 2005. Why is that case so important?
Well, Enhorn and Sweden seems to be the only case on the part of Article 5.1e which allows detention on the grounds of prevention of the spreading of infectious disease. And that was a case where someone who was HIV positive was told not to go and kind of infect other people, disobeyed various restrictions linked to that, and then was detained under this article for around 18 months. And that was found to be contrary to the convention. And in that article, by analogy with other parts of Article 5.1e, the court set out a two-part test for whether detention is compatible with that article, with that provision. The test is whether the spreading of the disease is dangerous for public health or safety, which certainly is true in our case. And secondly, whether detention of the person infected is the last resort in order to prevent the spreading of the disease, because less severe measures have been considered and found to be insufficient to safeguard the public interest. And so in our case, while it's difficult to analogize here, you can see two immediate issues. The first is, on its face, that requires that the person who's detained actually be infected. Obviously, in this case, for fairly good reasons, we are not simply isolating people, we're also quarantining them. We're also quarantining people where we don't know whether they're affected. And I set out in the article a few reasons why I think it's likely that this will be interpreted broadly enough to include those who are reasonably suspected of being infected.
It seems to me that Article 5 really isn't fit for purpose in this particular situation, because it doesn't cover or it doesn't provide for an exception for people who are not infected. And we can't expect, I mean, the harm that you can do to other people could be a factor in dictating your life choices in these circumstances. But obviously not everyone is going to be altruistic about this. So this is where the law comes in, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, there's a very difficult and interesting balance to strike here between asking people to voluntarily go along with self-isolation, which is what the UK's approach has been so far, and coming in with the full force of the law. I mean, in Italy, we've seen 40,000 people who have been prosecuted under the decrees that I mentioned at the beginning. And so there's, apart from the legal aspect, there's an effectiveness angle of, if you immediately come in with the full force of the law, do people in fact react to that and go out where they wouldn't otherwise? But in terms of Article 5's fitness for purpose, I mean, it depends. It's true, on my reading of Article 5.1e itself, it doesn't actually limit itself to people who are infected. It says that the justification must be the prevention of the spreading of infectious disease. It doesn't say the person must be infected. And quarantine is a quite long-standing measure. Another thing that I think is relevant is the International Health Regulations from 2005, which are the binding piece of law that regulates how these things are done. Specifically provides for quarantine, and one of its articles requires that other bits of international law, such as the convention, be interpreted in harmony with it. So I think there's a fairly strong argument that, at least on the Article 5.1e point, Article 5 can be made fit for purpose.
So that's just two articles that you focus on, but you mentioned, of course, a whole range of other provisions of the European Convention which will be relevant to this situation.
Given the extent of these measures which are interfering with pretty much every part of everyday life, the number of human rights issues that arise is absolutely huge. And one way to start looking at this is the background paper published by the Joint Committee on Human Rights, used the consultation they're doing on this, which is around, I think, 14 pages and goes through a very wide number of convention issues that are raised by this. Just to flag a few of the most obvious, first, Article 8, particularly in the UK, given that we don't have the Protocol 4, the degree of interference in terms of people not being able to go see family members, to go see friends if they are sufficiently isolated, not be able to go to work, which is also protected under Article 8. Similarly, any privacy issues that might arise from any tracking of data, as we've seen occur in South Korea. And quite apart from that, at some point we might get into a situation where forced medical examinations or even treatment is being administered, and the convention has pretty strong protection against that. As I read the bill yesterday, it is possible to forcibly test people, but not to treat or vaccinate them. And that is generally in accordance with the case law of the court, although it should be noted that there are some strains in the court's case law suggesting that forcible vaccination might be justified in some circumstances. That's the case of Solomakin in Ukraine, as a case currently before the Grand Chamber of the court about this exact issue.
And that would presumably relate to Article 8, protecting the autonomy of the person, is that correct?
Yes, and the physical and mental integrity of them.
And what about businesses and the massive detrimental effect that the current measures are having on most businesses? That's obviously a relevant convention right too, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, this obviously raises very large issues under Article 1 of the first protocol, which is the right to property. I think someone who is an expert in commercial law and a matter such as this needs to do a properly in-depth analysis of what constraints Article 1 of Protocol 1 place on the government in situations like this. I mean, I suspect that in many of the cases where it's a kind of indirect consequence of the lockdowns, it will be justifiable. The more interesting case will be the cases of expropriation, which we've seen, where temporary expropriation occur, for example, in Spain, where bits of industry are commandeered to produce ventilators and so on.
Very interesting. You say in your article that human rights law fails if detailed, uncertain analysis is needed by panicked, stretched states when orienting emergency measures. I mean, isn't this exactly what is happening, or at least is about to happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a fair argument that there is. I mean, we've started to see bit by bit the relevant human rights bodies come out and give some guidance. So there was a statement on the 16th of March from pretty much all of the special rapporteurs of the United Nations, for example. But the guidance they're giving is very limited and it's very vague. So there, for example, the focus is on non-discrimination, quite reasonably, not using these measures as a cover for oppression and ensuring that we return to normality as soon as possible. But that is not the kind of detailed guidance that states need when they are working out, you know, what procedures do we need to put in place, if any, before we detain someone? What level of movement restriction can we reasonably do under the convention? What particular measures do we need to do or put in place to protect those who are disabled, vulnerable, minors, and so on and so forth? To what degree do we have to guarantee the right to education in a situation like this? And so what's strikingly absent is, at least from the official UN and, for example, the Council of Europe bodies, is any detailed guidance about precisely how this happens. And I searched and I couldn't find any soft law that specifically addressed in detail how this should happen. We've had some other statements from NGOs, notably Human Rights Watch, which are a bit more extensive. But again, my feeling is that some detailed soft law about how precisely one should act in a circumstance like this and what human rights should be considered would be very valuable.
Would it not be a likely scenario that a lot of states are just going to throw their hands up and derogate under Article 15 of the Convention, which they're allowed to do?
Yes, so we're starting to see that. Latvia was the first country to derogate last week and derogate from Articles 8, 11, Article 2, the first protocol, and Article 2 of the fourth protocol. And since, more notifications have come. So Romania, Armenia and Moldova have since derogated from a variety of rights. But what's striking again is that the rights that the countries are derogating for differs from state to state. So it's clear that there is still confusion and somewhat of a lack of clarity about what precisely do ordinary human rights obligations require us to do, and therefore, what, if anything, do we need to derogate from? One particularly interesting point is that Guatemala has derogated from the ICCPR, the UN level treaty, but as far as I can tell, is not derogated from the American Convention on Human Rights. So I think whilst a derogation is allowed, and it's likely that it would be justifiable if parts of the convention do not allow sufficient flexibility, what's striking again is that states are not being consistent on this. And for example, France, Spain and Italy, who, as far as I can tell, have adopted the most restrictive measures to date, including ones that may raise issues under Article 5, such as those that we've discussed, haven't logged derogations, at least to date.
I suppose if we all get out of this more or less without too many fatalities, do you foresee in practice a rush of challenges to government action under the European Convention and indeed other human rights instruments?
That is an interesting question. I suspect that the key point that's going to be interesting is that for the first month or two, this is going to be accepted. And it's notable that almost all the emergency provisions adopted by other states and notified to the relevant treaty bodies envisage being enforced around a month, whereas the UK's bill currently envisages this being enforced for 2 years, which might well turn out to be more realistic. So I suspect that firstly, a series of challenges are likely to come if this becomes the new normal for an extended period of time. And secondly, It might well be that in this initial period, there have been, in particular, vulnerable groups who have been left behind. I mean, we've had reports from China of people who have leukemia and other issues who've been unable to be treated because they've essentially been blocked from going to hospital by the movement restrictions. And if that kind of thing starts to happen, you can imagine cases even about this early stage where, again, states haven't necessarily adopted measures that are precisely calibrated to protect the most vulnerable coming through.
Well, now, we've pretty much covered what's been going on recently. We can't, of course, predict what's going to happen going forward. But thank you so much for coming on to LawPod UK to explain the situation to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You will find links to most of the laws, convention articles, and, of course, the derogations referred to by Niall in his original post on the UK Human Rights blog, published on the 17th of March. And the more recent developments are cited in the blog post accompanying this episode.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.